Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fast Break Podcast. This is Aman Kidwai. I'm joined by Patrick Martin and Dan Madigan. We are coming off the Huskies' home regular season finale. They whomp Seton Hall by 30 points. It was an emotional day as four seniors and one very special dog were being honored at Gamble Pavilion in Storrs. UConn also clinched the outright Big East title. Madigan, what did you think about just the Seton Hall game overall?
I was really impressed. I think there was a lot of things leading into this game. I think we talked about it on our last podcast, but this was one of only three teams this year to beat UConn at any point this season. And let's be honest, this is not like the others. Seton Hall is not like Creighton. They're not like Kansas. They are not a top 10, top 15 caliber team. They are not in the fringe Elite Eight, Final Four discussion. Like, it was a weird game. And yes, Donovan Clingan got hurt, but honestly, UConn just didn't play that well in that Big East opener and didn't deserve to win anyways. And I think the fact that it was Dan Hurley's alma mater and it being senior day this time around, it just made it all sting a little bit more. And I think it was very clear that UConn wanted to blow the doors off of Seton Hall, win the regular season Big East title at home, and get ready for, you know, an absolutely brutal stretch against Marquette and Providence to finish out the year and head into tournament play and try and repeat. That's kind of how I thought it would go down. And the crowd was rambunctious from the beginning. The senior day ceremony was awesome. Fans were there early, clapping loud. Hurley was an absolute mess walking out with his son, and then Kim Spencer came out and he like immediately snapped out of it and like punched him in the chest and like just started yelling like, "Let's go, let's go." Just an unbelievable, like, classic Dan Hurley gesture. And they played incredible. Steph Castle was unbelievable. Put the absolute clamps on Kadari Richmond, who, you know, is one of the best UConn killers in the new Big East era that I can think of. Maybe Zagorowski on Creighton is in that conversation too, but Castle was unreal on both ends. 21 points on offense. Richmond had 13 points, but he didn't really do anything until midway through the first half. He was just completely bottled up, and UConn just went for the jugular. Seton Hall absolutely packed it in with about 8 minutes left. And I understand it's a business decision. They were down, you know, 20 or whatever, 15. But it was one of the most abysmal displays of basketball that I've seen. It was honestly embarrassing. And as someone who was riding with Seton Hall for a long time, for a big part of this season, I was embarrassed. Shaheen Holloway should be embarrassed. It was just a terrible performance with the starters still in to just see everyone absolutely mail it in and let UConn run all over them. But it did allow for some really cool moments for the Huskies. So wasn't all bad. Andrew Hurley scored the last point of the season in Gamble Pavilion. A lot of hugs, a lot of high fives, a lot of confetti all around. So overall, a good just butt whooping from the Huskies.
I mean, they went into the big guy nonstop. The first 10 minutes, they were just establish. It was real clear that when they lost, they looked at that game as like, all right, we were in a good spot until he went down. Besides Jaden Bediako, there is no one within, I think, 4 or 5 inches in height of Klingon. And Bediako was, he looked like he was lost out there. How many, he got, has he ever seen a pick and roll? The switches and the staggers. I mean, it was, and they got whatever they wanted. And it was one of those games that when you start to look at the stats after, it's like, I can't do anything with this. There's not a lot of, like, you know, takeaways to be had from a statistical perspective of, like, what UConn did. Like, they just, because Seton Hall, like, gave up at the first 5 minutes of the second half. But the one that did stand out was, as seen in our rapid recap on the Fast Break, 8% turnover rate for UConn, which was their best of the season. And that's something that I think is getting glossed over in all like the amazing shit that's happening is Hassan Diarra and Stephen Castle, like all the secondary ball handlers, throw Cam Spencer in there, have been so, so good running UConn's like very intricate offense without, you know, Hassan Diarra hasn't had three turnovers, hasn't had more than two turnovers in a game since St. John's. And that was actually his only three turnover game of the Big East slate. He's just been so good, you know, spelling Newton for those stretches when you need a change of pace. We'll get to Newton eventually, and we'll get to Castle. And then you factor in, like, we also need to have a discussion about Klingon's passing. I mean, he's an excellent passer, and I feel like that's getting thrown under the radar. You know, for a 7'2" dude to be able to initiate a lot of actions. And yeah, that's kind of like the only real takeaway that I could pick out from it in the stats afterwards. I mean, 24 points off turnovers. Seton Hall was just pissing the ball away. But I did see an interesting stat, and you guys can say if this matters or not. I saw that UConn is second in the country in assist differential with like a 9.8 plus. So that means that essentially they're turning not turning teams over a ton, but they're just running such a better offense, and they're getting just enough fast break points to get by. I don't know. I thought it was an interesting stat.
I am not familiar with that information. I'm just not familiar with that metrics game, frankly, but I have been monitoring the assist rate across the season, and it has been something that's been really high for the Huskies. It's not one of the four factors like the KenPom efficiency thing, but I think it still is a fun little stat there that lets you know just kind of how well UConn shares the ball, how well it moves the offense. And yeah, Klingon, you know, his ability to be able to run whatever it is they run and move out there in the perimeter when he does get the ball, I do find to be impressive. And I did like you said, the way they were able to go to him, and he showed a little bit more refined of a low post game. I think we're starting to see a little bit more comfort on that end from him. I liked what we saw from Diarra and Samson Johnson a little bit in there. 7 points for Samson Johnson. And, you know, I also just wanted to add that with Castle and Klingon, they both had early season injuries and are now kind of powering up and realizing their full potential. So what's crazy is, for as great as UConn has been, there still is even more upside to till as this defense, well, as the you know, those extremely good players make their impact felt on both ends of the court.
There was one play in particular. I think it was in the first half, where Klingon got the ball kind of like on the elbow, and Caravan, as always, our boy Caravan's always going to be cutting. It was wide open for just a backdoor cut. And like, Klingon saw him, but you could see his wheels turning of like, no, like, I think I can take this guy off the dribble. And two dribbles, body first, layup. I think he missed the layup, but he hit the free throws. And he did that again in the second half, like facing up and like just trying to go by somebody. Just use your long legs and long reach, take two dribbles and put it up there. And that's a really good skill to start to develop when you're thinking about the next level of, like, you know, if someone has to guard him face to, you know, chest to chest, then you can't just kind of like get up on him. Like, you're going to have to, you know, choose your spacing. And it's like, yeah, that was, I think, the progression like you're talking about, where like, he maybe in January, he just hits Caravan for that simple pass. And now it's like, okay, well, let me see what I can. He's starting to feel his, you know, feel his athleticism out there.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with his passing ability overall. And I think the concerns about his offensive game have been a little overrated, just because he's not going to be really asked to back up and post guys up in the NBA. But stuff like that, like he did on that example there that you mentioned, Patrick, where he's backing a guy down and sees a cutter and throws it over his shoulder, that's something that will translate to pro level. I think he's always been a solid passer out of the high post. He's shown that a lot, like even in high school when I went to go see him play and stuff like that. And I think some of it is, and maybe this is maybe a little bit of a reach, but like, he was playing against freaking Farmington High School. Like, they're double teaming him, triple teaming him every time he touched the ball. Like, he probably found out so freaking quick that he could get rid of it and find the open man. Whereas,
what's wrong with Farmington High School?
No, nothing against Farmington High School. Go whatever their team name is now, but you know, if he's playing it at the high prep level, he's facing guys one-on-one all the time, right? So it's just a different development cycle. I think it's been really cool to just see him mature really in front of our eyes. Like, he's so much lighter on his feet, and obviously lighter. Seems like he lost weight since his injury, and I think everything is starting to come together, and he's really starting to hit his stride. I know my wife and I were watching a replay of the Final Four game a few days back, and Klingon really looks like an entirely different player. He's doing a lot of the same things, but the way that he's moving and the way that he's kind of finding spots, whether it's on drop coverage or defense or rolling to the hoop on offense, like, he's just moving so much better. And I think that's really just opened up a whole new dimension to his game. Even though he's not having the, like, Zach Edey takeover that some people expected, he's gotten so much better, so much faster than, like, any other big man that's come through UConn in recent memory, really.
In his last seven games, he's 13.3 points, 8 rebounds, 2 assists, 3 blocks per game on 64% from the field, and, like, very respectable 66% from free throw in 24 minutes. In 24 minutes, that's insane. You know, kudos to Zach Edey, I guess, for, like, being able to stay on the court longer. But I think that, you know, like, this is clearly something that Hurley has working with, like, the minute load. He doesn't want to ramp him up too much. He doesn't want to kind of throw him in for just 20 minutes. Would it surprise me if he starts to kind of creep up towards the 30 level more consistently, especially entering the stretch run and then the tournaments, for sure? But he told Bill Rafter or whoever was doing the game, is like, this is the best I felt. Like, he said, I kind of was bullshitting when I said I was, like, healthy in January, or, you know, healthy after coming back to start the season. So the fact that he's, like, moving that well, there's no longer, at least for me, like, when he hits the floor or has, like, some kind of awkward play, I'm not wincing anymore. I feel good that he's going to get up and be fine. Maybe that's just, like, he's built up enough games. I think after the seat, like, the first time he got back, it was like, oh my God, dude, like, please, just, like, please be careful. Now it's like, okay, you're fine, dude. You got this. He's not. And I think that's going to, hopefully, the longer he continues to play like that, it will distance himself from, like, the injury prone label that, like, 7-2 people unfortunately get for good reason. But so far, I think he's athletic enough to avoid those kind of, like, freak, like the Kristaps Porzingis stuff where he, like, falls weird and tweaks something and he's hurt for 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's best shape of their life season. Spring training is coming around. Pitchers and catchers have reported, you know, you're getting those reports trickling out that so-and-so is in the best shape of their life. Why not Donovan Klingon too, right? But the only difference is I truly believe it for all the reasons that you said, Patrick. He does look better, healthier, more confident out there too. Like, I think there was times where he was moving around where he probably felt fine, but didn't really want to push it, didn't want to test that foot of his. So really cool to see him healthy and playing great basketball this season. It's just been awesome to see him dominate teams for major stretches this year.
Pretty cool also that he will be the last 32 worn. Like, I know their styles aren't different, but to have 32 go out for, like, a Connecticut kid like Klingon from Rip to there, pretty sick.
Yeah, and also, by the way, may have been Klingon's last game in Gamble, but yeah, I think as it relates to the fully activated Donovan Klingon that you're alluding to, I think it's coming. I think you mentioned his stats over the last seven games. He's had his first double-double in that seventh game, going seven games back, February 6th. That was his first one of the season. He's had three all since then. So I think he's getting activated. He's approaching a point where he's going to see more time. He might have his Amida Brima Coppin State game in round one of the NCAA tournament.
Oh, that was electric.
Yeah. He's going to do that, I think, in round one of the NCAA tournament this year. He's going to be able to have, you know, some really good cumulative stats for the NCAA tournament thanks to that game. But look, he's powering up offensively. There are a lot of teams sized like Seton Hall that UConn could meet in the NCAA tournament, and it's going to have that advantage over them, and that same advantage when Samson Johnson goes in too. So it's a scary, scary thing with Klingon and Castle both, like we said,
So
doing that.
One last point I'll make too is with him being the dude now down low, UConn was 1 of 8 from three in the first half. But they were still up, what, like 11, 12 points because they were shooting 63% inside the arc and had like what, 7 offensive rebounds. That balance is like so, so important. You never want to be a team that just like relies just on the Karabans and the Spencers and the Newtons to hit your shots. If the shots aren't falling, just throw it into the big guy or run sets to get like Caravan making cuts or Samson Johnson lob threat. There are so many contingency plans in place in case the threes aren't falling. They're not some like run and gun, live by the three, dive by the three team. And that should be comforting for any fan that's like worried about like an upset bid.
So there were a number of guys who were playing their final game in Gamble Pavilion. The seniors were honored. You mentioned Andrew Hurley, Cam Spencer, also Tristan Newton, who we'll have to spend some time doing some appreciating, and Hassan Diarra. But Tristan Newton, by the way, recently announced in the top five for the Cousy Award. So some really exciting national recognition for him. I think he's making the case for himself in the Big East Player of the Year conversation, although we kind of just say that for a different guy every two games here on the Fast Break podcast. That's our personal guarantee. But Tristan Newton, folks, he's had three straight double-doubles, 9 on the season. He's just been so consistent and reliable. And how are you guys feeling about his Big East Player of the Year chances here?
Well, I think the biggest thing, or maybe one of the biggest pieces to that news, is the Tyler Kolek news, right? For anyone that doesn't know, Kolek is out for the remainder of the regular season, won't play against UConn, and I think they have one more game against Villanova. In my eyes, that kind of takes him out of the discussion. I don't think he was the front runner. I believe that's probably Baylor Shireman right now from Creighton, and deservedly so. He's had a great season, but I just think Newton has been so impressive. And I know, Patrick, I don't want to step too much on your take because I was reading your takeaways and I thought they were awesome, but Newton's kind of just doing everything for an objectively better team. He's doing what I'm going to coin as the Christian Vital, which is lead the team in points, rebounds, and assists right now. And it's all in the flow of the offense. Like, he's done so many different things. I think I called him a offensive chameleon. Like, there's games where he needs to score 25 to win. There's other games where he needs to score 6 points and rip down 12 boards and dish out 8 rebounds. Like, he can just do a little bit of everything, and that flexibility and that versatility really opens up the rest of the offense. So I think for the team that's the outright winner of the regular season, I imagine that they would have to have the best player in the conference, or, you know, one of the best players. And I think that's what's going to give Newton that edge, just by being an equally good player, probably a little better, but on a much better team.
People forget he was left off every single preseason Big East team award, whatever. Not even anything, not even honorable mention. Just throwing that out there. I don't even know why are we doing preseason stuff at this point? Because like, so many of them, just it all depends on how the season breaks. I don't know. Just like, call it players to watch or something, or some shit like that, to avoid yourself the embarrassment. But I saw Newton is now fourth in the country in Evan Maya's box BPR, which measures statistical output. Tyler Kolek, I think it was second, but again, we'll you know, we already said, he kind of has taken himself out. Plus, you know, Marquette just hasn't really passed the eye test in a lot of ways, I think. And that's kind of resulted in, like, I think kind of like so much of that award is the narrative. Last year, Marquette stormed onto the scene and, you know, blew through both the regular season and the Big East tournament, with Kolek leading the charge. Now it was a little more of a rockier journey, plus UConn being just better as we saw at, you know, at the home game in the Civic Center. Schuylerman, yeah, he's great, and as Madigan said, like, but he's more of like a, you know, he's hunting his own shot. He's not necessarily getting people involved. I know he averages, I think, 4 or 5 assists per game, but that's also because Creighton is just like taking a zillion trillion shots. But Tristan Newton is like the de facto, he's the point guard. He is, you know, he has, like you said, so many different roles that he is all just, he's pushing every lever correctly at the right time, timely offensive boards, the free throw shooting, you know, like when you just need a quick bucket and some in the bonus, just give it to him, get out of the way. He draws a foul. And then, you know, like, it's like people that deserve that award are ones that are consistent throughout the season. You can make the case earlier in the year that it was Kadari Richmond or Devin Carter, but both of those, you know, Providence and Seton Hall have both dropped 2 games in a row. And like, you really needed those games. If Seton Hall and Providence started, like, you know, finishing strong, you know, on the backs of Richmond and Carter, then yeah, you could really make a case. But the fact that UConn is so far finishing strong and, you know, is this monster, it's got to go to Newton, I think, unless there's some dramatic turn in postseason play.
I talked about him a little bit at the in the Seton Hall game, but I guess we didn't talk about him. Steph Castle winning freshman of the week for a 10th week, tying Carmelo Anthony's Big East record. And he's going to have a good shot at breaking that record, which would be really cool. I think that'd be an incredible achievement. And, you know, I think, Aman, you touched on this. We've seen this too. Like, he dealt with typical freshman stuff, that knee injury at the beginning of the season, bounced back, had that slow burn, and now is just an absolute monster, you know, on both ends of the floor. The 3-point shot hasn't always been, you know, lights out, but he was shooting over 35% for a significant stretch. I think he's cooled off a little now, but he's hit enough of them to make defenses think about it and not sag off him and give him that old school Andre Jackson treatment. But I think his improvement on both ends has just been really remarkable. I think he's really kind of molded his game to fit exactly what Dan Hurley needs, which is really cool to see from such an elite recruit. I also think it really benefits him that he's able to do that and do it so well. So I think it helps kind of everyone. But just been so impressed with his ability to attack one-on-one. I think Hurley is more comfortable kind of giving him the ball on offense and just letting him beat his guy, because there's really nobody at this level on a night in and night out basis that can stop him when he wants to get downhill and get to the hoop. And he's really just kind of earned that right with the way he's been playing lately. And Seton Hall did give up towards the end. He definitely had some easy baskets for some highlight reel dunks, but he was getting by guys all game. And he's just been so relentless on both ends. It's really reminded me a lot of the changes that Hurley made in the offense to kind of unleash Andre Jackson last year during the championship run. I wouldn't say this has all been a change that Hurley has made directly, but just having confidence in Castle and kind of letting him play his game and letting him, you know, roam a little bit more freely in the offense has kind of allowed him to contribute. And I think it's given him confidence to be more aggressive on defense too. And he's just at his size, at his speed, at his athleticism, he can really guard so many different people. And Kadari Richmond is an NBA player. And Castle just bottled him up and pretty much took him completely out of the game for a good chunk of it. So just been so impressed by him. And he really could be like one of the best freshmen in Big East history. If he wins another Freshman of the Week award and wins Freshman of the Year, he has to be in that conversation, which is really cool and I think really well-deserved.
He definitely deserves all, what is it, 11 of them? But holy shit, is there ever going to be some competition? Like, what did every other team just not recruit? Like, the next nearest guys is like the Providence guy who like had a good stretch for a little bit. The Brady Dunlap guy from St. John's, Green from Xavier, but like, that is a very, very weak crop of freshmen, just as an aside. But regarding Castle, looked up his last 10 games, he's shooting 39% from three, with a 2.7 assist to turnover ratio. And that's all you want from your secondary ball handler. But I do think there is going to be one game coming up that's like a holy shit takeover game where it's like, fuck the offense, just like give him the ball and get out of his way, because no one can keep in front of him, and he's gonna just put up like 20, 25 points and just be like, everyone's gonna be like, imagine this guy in the NBA. Like that's gonna there's gonna be a fully realized Stephon Castle coming up probably in the next 5 or 6 games. And the fact that he's also doing this while defending the team's best player, taking those assignments. There are a lot of good 6'6", like 6'6", 6'7" guys out there in the college game. The team that like I've always like been secretly scared of, and this is fast forwarding really far ahead to like March or to the NCAA tournament, is Dalton Knecht from Tennessee. Like this like 6'6" dude who can kind of like, beat you from the, outside or take you off the dribble. And it's just very comforting to know that you can stick Castle on him and he's going to make life miserable for him.
I think just looking at the list of guys that Castle has been taking on as a defensive assignment, it really is crazy and very impressive. Like you said, Kadari Richmond, Kolick, Devin Carter, that's it, right? Like that's a lot of different folks on Creighton that he d'd up in the first meeting at home. So it's really been a crazy list of guys that he's done that to, and then to also be able to be such a unique and impressive contributor offensively, it's just amazing. And then for UConn, it's a luxury, obviously, to have him there in that situation as he's like the fifth leading scorer on the team right now. Maybe he's inched up a little bit on that, but really impressive stuff. I think he received the question about, is this your last game at Gamble? And just kind of smirked, and then someone came in with a second question right after Donovan Klingon answered it. The question was like, "Donovan, Steph, do you think this was your last game at Gamble?" And Donovan answered, "No, like no, I'm not thinking about it." Castle just smirked, and then some guy came in with another question. So we didn't get Castle's full response there, but.
No, they're gone. And we want them to be gone because that means you kind of had a successful postseason.
For sure. Yeah, no, we would never hold somebody back from their dreams, and they most certainly are deserving of it. We do have to say, in light of UConn clinching the Big East and that top seed, Marquette, as we mentioned, slipping a bit in the rankings. They're down to 8 in the AP poll. And also, like you said, just not having as much juice as a program. We had this game circled on the calendar as something that would be a huge moment. Do you feel like the game's lost a little bit of juice because of all of the circumstances here? Not really that much on the line anymore. UConn won the Big East by so much, and Marquette's going to be undermanned. So how are we feeling heading into this Marquette game on Wednesday?
So I ran all this info by our UConn blog stats and info department, which is just Sean McGrath in an Excel spreadsheet for 3 or 4 hours a day. But he told us this is the fifth top 10 matchup that UConn has had this season, which ties a program record with 2 other seasons. But I was joking with him, and I'm saying it in jest, but I kind of think it's true. And like, is this the most meaningless top 10 matchup in UConn history? Like there's really no stakes for either team at this game. I would say, for Marquette, a win over UConn with Kolick out would be a good resume builder, but I almost feel like they're kind of locked in. And when Kolick, it seems like Kolick will be healthy for the Big East tournament or the NCAA tournament. The seeding is going to be all screwed up, and I kind of feel like the committee won't even really care about these games one way or another. And for UConn, I think winning at Marquette would be an accomplishment. I know winning at Providence certainly would be at the end of the week, something they haven't done in over 10 years. So I think there's a desire there to finish this season out strong. But if this game gets away from them, like it did in that Creighton game, I can't really see Hurley riding with the starters for 25, 35 minutes. I think he's just going to try and get those guys their minutes and just make sure that nothing crazy happens and get out of Milwaukee with everybody intact. So I think the Providence game is a different story. I think there's some demons to exercise there. And Providence is going to be hungry because they need that win to really make sure that they're in the tournament picture. But yeah, this Marquette game, unfortunate that Kolek isn't healthy. You always want to see these teams at full strength when you go against them. Hopefully that'll be the case as we get deeper into March. But yeah, I think it has lost a little bit of its juice.
It's lost juice for us for sure. But let's not doubt for 1 second that Dan Hurley wants to beat the ever-loving shit out of Marquette, beat the ever-loving shit out of Providence. And even if they're down by 20 with 13 minutes to play against Marquette, he's still gonna have his guys out there. Maybe not Donovan Klingon as much. I think he will be a little more careful about that. But no one else really has any like lingering injury issues, knock on wood. We're forgetting he's a psychopath. He's going to try to win that game. And I think that there is a little bit of a looming black mark on like the lack of road wins that I think he really wants to get past. Doesn't that have to be Marquette, but just like, I think he wants one of those wins in the last two games of the year just to say like, all right, we got a road win. Because you know, you see so many times like Providence, oh, they're really, really good at home, but they kind of stink when you get away from the dunk or whatever. That narrative will start to get some legs if UConn continues just to have this sharp skew of home and aways. You want to be a team that can go into a road environment and win, or at least keep things close. They've shown they can keep it close, thinking of Kansas, but you want to see an actual result. And I think that's going to be what they're playing for these last two games.
Yeah, Patrick, I think that's a good point. I think if they can put together two convincing wins, like really convincing wins, which, you know, they beat Marquette by 28 last time. If they, you know, I think it's unlikely, but if they do something like that again and, you know, defeat Providence by a similar margin, I kind of think they're in the mix for the number one overall seed. You know, like there is that still to play for. That's never been done at UConn. I'm sure that's kind of what Dan Hurley is harping on. I would push back on the home road thing. And the only thing I would say is that I think Dan Hurley said this too, is like their point is to be built for the tournament. And in those neutral site games this year that they played earlier in the year, they were, you know, nothing short of amazing. They were great when they played at MSG, when they played in a, you know, semi-neutral environment in Seattle against Gonzaga. So I personally put a little bit more stock into that, but I'm sure the committee is valuing those road wins a little more. The last thing I'll say about the Marquette game is, you know, looking at the last time these two teams played, I'm at risk of getting aggregated here. Kolek being out could be something that Marquette could rally around. He wasn't a factor in the UConn, the game against UConn last time. He did pretty much nothing. He was completely bottled up by Castle. So they're so strung, like hamstrung with that offense running entirely through him. Maybe it's going to be a different result this time around with some other talent out there. So
the Patrick Ewing effect with
the
with
Ewing
Tyler
theory
Kolek.
Committee is out in Milwaukee for this.
That
game
would be, honestly, I think not all of us are huge Tyler Kolek fans of his personality. That would be absolutely hysterical if Marquette turned out to be like a better team without him. Of like, I'm the maestro, I'm the string puller. No, actually, like, you know, you're just a guy.
And Gold is just prime Steph Curry now.
Yeah,
launching from deep.
Would be very Belichickian to allow that loss so that Marquette builds confidence without their best player. So I think with the road win, I agree as it relates to resume. It's a good thing to have on the resume. When people get into, oh, UConn has never won on the road against a ranked team, you know, in 5 years under Dan Hurley and 10 years after that, it's like, I don't care about that. I don't lose any sleep over losing a bunch of road ranked games in 2016. Today, I do not think about that. So that's less of a big deal. I think the opportunity to cop, you know, a solid road win here it is worthwhile, and to sweep Marquette going into a year where Marquette was predicted to, by quite a bit, to be first in the conference in the preseason poll. To be able to sweep them would be something to play for. And then I think, like you said, playing for that number one overall seed, that's the other piece of it. But I was, you know, again, preseason, you look at this game on the schedule, you were hoping for it to be maybe having a little bit of a deciding role in the final Big East rankings, but UConn was too good and Marquette was too bad.
Yeah, Aman, you and I were going to take down Milwaukee.
I know, I hear great things.
I was so stoked all winter, looking forward to that. And man, shame on Delta, and shame on all the major airlines for really jacking up those prices out of Cincinnati.
Right.
I'm a Delta guy, but like I'm holding my people accountable here. Very disappointed in that. Because like, yeah, even if this game is relatively meaningless, I would have liked to go up there, get my hands on some Spotted Cow, check out Milwaukee, maybe bump into Andre Jackson Jr. who probably would be at the game, if they're home. But yeah, no, airlines had different ideas. Hate to see it.
Maybe next year.
Absolutely. I also think we should talk about those preseason rankings just quickly, because UConn didn't have a single vote. And I think looking back on it, it seems absolutely whack. But in the vacuum of the preseason, I think I said that they should have probably gotten one vote from someone, because the talent was there. And we've talked about this at length, where everyone that needed to take a leap and become great has done that. And that's why UConn is where they are now. But it's still pretty crazy that the defending champions, yes, they did lose a lot of talent, but guys like Tristan Newton, we're still back there. Like Donovan Clingan was back. Like there was still enough talent to see how they could be in the mix for the regular season title. And it's still pretty jarring to look back at that preseason poll and see that, wow, they didn't have any votes. And yes, they were projected for third place, which is still, you know, an achievement in its own right, but pretty surprising and kind of the chip on the shoulder that I think this team needed following the championship to not have any respect to even be within earshot of a regular season title and then winning it outright at the end of the year.
I have a take, and it may not hold up, but, you know, putting myself on the record here, I'm putting my name behind something. I'm going to stand for something. I have a growing worry that like the Big East dramatically underperformed this year. UConn obviously is really, really good. Marquette solid, you know, good. Creighton good. Providence would have been really, really good with Bryce Hopkins. But besides that, I think UConn's lack of preseason recognition was less of like what UConn had and more of, I think everyone else was valuing St. John's to be better than they were, not to be like a maybe bubble team, Xavier to be a little better than they were, Villanova to have like a coach that can coach, Seton Hall was a lower preseason, but like, I think the middle of that pack, Butler to be a little bit better. I think that middle of the pack, we're going, I hope I'm wrong, but that middle of the pack, that when we're sitting here, like, you know, very happy with road wins against Butler and Xavier without Donovan Clingan, those aren't holding up as much weight as they did. And my one worry is that, like, even like the non-conference win of like North Carolina wasn't playing great at that time. Gonzaga isn't that good this year. This is in no way saying that like UConn is like vulnerable to an upset, but there could be that narrative out there that if this season does end in a disaster scenario, that would be like the likely cause of like, yeah, well, it's like the Big East just wasn't that good, so they like kind of stormed through and weren't really tested besides the road games because they have this, you know, a crazy home environment. I don't know. I mean, you can roast me for that, but I think there is truth behind that, like the middle of the pack has underperformed a little bit.
I think that's fair to say that the bottom has fallen out a little bit. And I think some of that is because Georgetown and DePaul weren't just regular bad. They were like really, really bad.
Yeah, like
and
his
I think,
like screw up your metrics bad.
Yeah, but a quick little jog over to KenPom still has the Big East as the second best conference in the country by adjusted efficiency, and pretty close to the Big 12, honestly. And
there
you know
go.
The you know Fugazi metrics that they do over there to boost all the ratings. So
numbers don't lie.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's a good point. Maybe this is just me being pessimistic, but I just don't know how much the committee even really cares about when. I think it's just who, for better or for worse. Like, I just don't have a lot of faith in the committee, like, being that great at what they do, honestly. I feel like, you know, you go look at resumes and stuff, and it seems like they screw stuff up every year. And I think they really just look at, is everyone healthy? Who did you beat, no matter when it was? And then they look maybe at that conference tournament finish and say, like, did you finish your season strong? Did you make it to your conference tournament title game or your semis and stuff like that? But it should work how you said it worked, Patrick. I just am a little like, I don't know if it actually works as they even say it works. And I think that's part of a bigger problem, but those wins that UConn have earlier in the season, I think they still hold a lot of weight, especially the neutral court ones.
Yeah, I agree that DePaul and Georgetown twice on the schedule each probably is the thing that hurts them the most there. And UConn played a really tough out-of-conference schedule. They went to Kansas. You know, that was a close loss there. And the Gonzaga game, like you mentioned, that was, you know, at least a semi-away, basically an away game. So I think they and then they played a lot of, you know, teams that were good or were supposed to be good in Madison Square Garden. And they've handled their business in the Big East, right? Like they're beating the crap out of these decently solid teams, NCAA tournament or bubble teams, and they're beating them all by 24 or more points, which is what the margin has been in the five last in their last five wins. So they're taking care of business in a big way in the league, and they did it out of conference too. So I think they've done a ton to prove themselves resume wise there.
I think what like started this take was looking at how bad Indiana is, but hey, I mean, they got a lot of pro people, I guess, whatever, Goodman, and seeing Texas be not that good, even though they're killing it right now. And then, I don't know, it's a very pessimistic take, because then like I would look at that Kansas game of like, all right, well, Tristan Newton just was like on another level, or else that game was going to be a blowout. But then say like, okay, Castle was out and Spencer was hobbled and everything. The narrative around like North Carolina is that like they're a much, much different team now than they were back in December. But I just think like those were like, my take is falling apart as I'm thinking about it, because those were games that they played in the Garden, and I don't consider that like a road environment. Like they had a home court advantage in all of those games, but at the same time, because they have just absolutely demolished the Big East, they're likely going to have Brooklyn and Boston, which will be home court advantages through the regionals. So I guess that doesn't hold up. My worry ultimately, you know, to boil it down, is that like I hope the Big East hasn't like shielded what this UConn team really is, because I think the Big East is a little down this year. Metrics, like Madigan said, say otherwise. I'm strictly going off eye test. I'm not sold on any team outside of Creighton and Marquette to make it past the first weekend. I hope I'm wrong, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Big East also, not to go too deep on any of these people, because who cares about Xavier, but you know, like Xavier was going to have a better team this year probably if it wasn't for a couple of injuries. So I do think you have to at least give that to them. Same for Providence. So I think that's where a little bit of quality got sapped away. And for the league, that when that's really two of the teams that were meant to be among the higher caliber teams in the league, that is a lot of quality sapped from the what was going to be two top half teams. So that is a shame. That's part of what happens. And then, yeah, look, DePaul, you did not need to be that bad. And Georgetown, kind of same. But I don't really like care about that so much. At this point, it's more like, you know, especially again, they've clinched their regular season goal here. You know, you want to get through these two games with everybody feeling all right, and you want to not have anything too disastrous happen. You don't want any incidents in the tunnel in Providence. You don't want anything like that to happen. We're just gonna get this regular season through, and then hey, Big East tourney in Madison Square Garden with UConn's best chance to take it in a while.
I think you guys wrote it somewhere, but like, in a perfect world, I'd like to see some solo ball, get solo ball 15 minutes per game, get Jalen Stewart 15 minutes per game. I know both of them haven't really found their shot lately. Or I think Ball might have hit a three recently, but Jalen Stewart has not. Get them a little bit of confidence in going, because right now UConn is only going seven deep with Diarra and Johnson. Stewart gives you like small little like 1 or 2 minute increments. But that would be like a goal of like, throw those guys out there in the first half and let them figure it out type situation. And because like, look, we all remember what Solo Ball could do earlier in the year. If he can regain that confidence the same way that Nyheim Aline regained his confidence towards the end of like the season last year and became this weapon off the bench that was good for at least 1-3, really tough defense for 10-15 minutes, that's huge. Because, you know, these games, you know, both tournaments are a gauntlet if you want to make it far. And I'd feel a lot more comfortable if you're going 8-9 deep as opposed to 7 deep.
Yeah, I mean, the solo ball thing is absolutely insane to me. He really hasn't played meaningful minutes since December, since the St. John's game, like against real competition. And I know it seems like he's kind of been in the doghouse a little bit. I know he missed like a blown assignment, or like he was late to a rotation on a three in the Xavier game, and they're up like 30 points, and Luke Murray just like absolutely exploded on him. And like, that could be an isolated incident, it could be a reflection of how things are going, I don't know, but it was like one of the most insane things. Like,
it was like a funny thing at the time, and then
yeah,
no one has seen solo ball since. Like, right? Holy shit, what happened?
Yeah. And like, the talent is there. It's not a confidence issue, I don't think. He comes in and he's always ready to shoot it. He had, you know, 3 points in 2 minutes against Marquette, 9 points in 10 minutes against DePaul. Like, he's looking for a shot. He can still shoot it. He's, you know, he played really important minutes for this team earlier in the year. And I think it's really important that he gets going again, because even if he does have some issues defensively, I think he can come in and spell Diarra or Castle or someone or Spencer for a few minutes at a time if there's foul trouble or something like that. So, yeah, he's a great player. I think he's also really important to the future of this team. So I think it's super important that he gets some minutes. He feels comfortable in what his role is going to be for the rest of this stretch run and what it looks like going into next year, because there's going to be a lot of change after this season, whenever it does end. And I think UConn is a lot better off if they can make sure that Solo Ball comes back next year instead of looking elsewhere. I'm not saying he's going to transfer, but it, you know, you have to imagine it's at least on the table after going. He was playing 20 minutes a game up through January, and things have happened. Diarra has become like the greatest sixth man in the history of the universe. Steph Castle's back, but
I mean,
there's still minutes for him, I think.
The Diarra stuff is wild. The night and day difference. I mean, he in complete control. He has an option to come back next year. I know his skill set is rumored to be slightly similar to Ahmad Knoll, coming in, so not sure about the fit there, but would love to have him back because he's gone from I can't remember a UConn player that has gone from a, oh boy, buckle up, he's in, to like a, okay, go get him, Haas. Like, I have full confidence. Like, change, set the tone. He's like Shorzy out there. Who wants to set the tone, boys? And it's awesome to see. And again, points to a little bit of the Samson Johnson narrative of like, wait your turn, take your lumps, like kind of like figure it out, and you're going to progress. The program has patience with people, I feel like. They showed patience with Hassan Diarra. They were committed to him even through some lumps, and they've been committed to Samson Johnson through some lumps. And I think that always turns out well when you work with guys and develop them as opposed to throwing them out there, expecting instant production. It doesn't work. Okay, well, we'll go get someone else. No, they're building with these guys, and it's good to see.
Will be cool for Haas, the Queens native, hopefully to do some damage in the Big East tournament. UConn looking to make the Big East tournament championship game for the first time since joining the league in 2020. This year, again, having secured the one seed, did we mention UConn is the one seed and won the Big East regular season? It looks like well, it doesn't look like they will play the winner of the 8-9 game. Which is going to be maybe Providence, Butler,
I thought it was Xavier Butler.
could be Xavier as of right now. And so, how are we feeling about this path? We'd have the 4-5 game on the other side. That's Seton Hall, Villanova, St. John's. That's who's in the mix there. How are we feeling about the potential path there in the Big East tourney?
I feel great that they have avoided Marquette and Creighton. Unless Marquette pulls some like shadow move here and like pulls Colic to drop their last two games and somehow slides down to the fourth seed because they, I mean, man, if they do that and UConn gets matched up with Shaka Smart in as a four seed, tip of the cap, stick tap to that because that's some 4D chess right there. But when you look at the upper half of the bracket, and I'm going off of the most recent update. Xavier Butler, St. John's, Seton Hall. Obviously, you don't want to play Seton Hall. Like Seton Hall is a team you least want to see just because you've beaten them before, but recency bias. They seem to have figured out the Shaheen Holloway puzzle and the Kadari Richmond puzzle. Also wouldn't love to see St. John's just because Madison Square Garden, but at the same time, that would be like the highest risk reward because oh, how sweet would it be to beat Slick Rick in the garden to advance to the
Yeah.
finals. And Xavier and Butler, thanks for playing. Unless you go in an absolute heater, in which case more power to you. But I love the draw because Marquette and Creighton will have to hopefully beat each other up, and you'll have a hopefully relatively fresh UConn team with a chip on its shoulder, looking for its first Big East title, waiting in the wings.
Yeah, I think you have to feel pretty good assuming that Creighton and Marquette could stay on the other side of the bracket. I think that's the absolute best case scenario. And there's some teams that are scary that UConn could run into before that. Like, I'm not dying to play Butler again. I know they've kind of been terrible lately, but they're a bad matchup, man. That guy Telfort, he's a bucket. I don't care. I'd
Nah,
rather not see them.
I don't want to see Butler next year, but right now, no,
Yeah.
I'm good.
Okay. I would be ready to play Xavier again in a heartbeat. St. John's doesn't really scare me a whole lot. But we'll see how things shake out. I think there's a lot of movement left, and the Colic piece is actually like a huge variable in all this because I think you could kind of say, like, oh, Marquette will definitely beat Villanova to end the season. And now, like, that's kind of all out the window. So it'll be interesting to keep tabs on that. It'll make the rest of the season really interesting to watch. For UConn fans, just to see how all these chips fall. But yeah, I think Marquette and Creighton being on the other side and not having to deal with either of those teams until the championship game is just huge. They're definitely the two teams most capable of defeating UConn consistently. And so by not having to worry about them until the championship game, that kind of, I think, allows UConn to play more freely and play more confidently and worry about that final showdown on Saturday.
Beyond the obvious, too, I don't want to see Villanova again just because, look, we're not very bullish on their coach, but they have so much talent. Like, and you've seen the games where they just go in and like, they went in and beat Providence on the road in a crucial, crucial bubble game. That was impressive. And you never know, like, the coaching hasn't been there right now, but like, if he finds something and this team starts clicking and the talent starts to shine through, Justin Moore is like quietly a UConn killer. Hopefully they stay on that bottom half of the bracket and they kind of have to like all take care of each other, because Seton Hall, St. John's, Butler, and Xavier, I think, are the four teams that I feel the most comfortable taking on in the first two rounds.
Those are also the four teams where you do not want to run into a fan or an alumnus from that school and have to have a casual conversation with them, because your ears will explode. So that's what I really don't want, is to have some Villanova fan in my face after, you know, after they win. If that were to happen, that would be basically worst case scenario. But the stakes will be high in Madison Square Garden. That is what it's all about. I do think a fun subplot is going to be which coaches are coaching their final game as the coach of XYZ school. We've got Greg McDermott as a very strong candidate to be leaving. Sean Miller from Xavier is a good candidate to be leaving. I am, just for fun, going to start floating Shaheen Holloway leaving rumors, just because I think, you know, it's just the responsible thing to do. Is to
that's
start
just
floating rumors.
That's just downright mean.
I mean, well, but the first two definitely have a very strong chance. But listen, Shaheen Holloway, that guy's got a bright future. And hey, if his team is giving up late in games, maybe he's got something worked out. Maybe he's going to Rutgers after Pikul goes somewhere else. You know, there's a lot of possibilities. Maybe he's going to Maryland after Willard gets fired.
this reminds me of like in The Office where Michael like tells a bunch of lies to cover up his one truth. And so, yeah, Amon, just like start throwing off some ridiculous shit. Like,
thank
you know,
you.
Richard Pitino is going to come in and play for, you know, Coach DePaul. And, you know, Ed Cooley is going to go back to Providence. And one of those will be true. I think we all know which one's going to be, but yeah.
When's the next 1842 day? Can we officially put Kyle Neptune on the hot seat? Like, I feel like that's like not the craziest thing ever. If they flame out early in the Big East tournament and don't make it, I don't know. I can see it. Jay Wright's right there. He's a phone call away.
So is Richard Pitino. I do not think that they are going to go. I don't think they're going to fire him. Again, I've been with much less information than you guys are taking in, I think. I've been on the kind of like, he's probably not that bad, and maybe it's just a bad situation. But at the very least, I do feel like Villanova feels very pot committed, and they have some sort of NIL, whatever. They don't spend a ton of money on football, probably. So all those crazy people can spend their... They can spend their whole wad on men's basketball, basically. And I think with some NIL power, they can do that. But you don't want to also be passing the hat around for a buyout when you have just taken on the added expense of the NIL budget, the annual NIL budget. So that's really my thinking there for why they are not going to make a change. I think what really it is a few guys who might take really large paychecks to go somewhere else, which is, of course, the shameful move, the low respect move. We do not respect that. The Big East is the haven of basketball. It plays a true round robin, which nobody else has. It is the true, it could crowns the one true champion. And that's why we love the Big East. But if you want to leave that, then you're not serious. So you weren't going to win anything anyway.
Sean Miller.
That is going to do it for us. Thank you all for listening.